It's time to step into the Coming Out Lounge, a cool, safe space to be true to your sexual self, with your host, Rick Clemens. Rick has helped hundreds of people come out of the closet, and now each week he's bringing you cool insights for loving and accepting yourself, boosting your self-confidence, and living a guilt-free, purpose-filled life on the other side of the closet doors. Cuddle up with yourself and get ready for heartwarming coming out stories, ideas for living authentically, and tips for being fully self-expressed. Now here's your host, Coming Out Coach Rick.
Hey, Closet Busters, it's time to come out and step up and step into living your powerful truth once again. Welcome to the Coming Out Lounge. I'm your host, Rick Clemens, the Coming Out Coach. And today we're going to go talk about, getting away. Or, is it getting away? How about leaving? Well, maybe that's not even it either. What we're going to talk about is stepping away from things that feel very organized. In fact, let's be honest, a majority of us LGBTQ individuals have found ourselves at the crossroads of our faith and our sexuality. In fact, I know for me and for most of us that faith often condemns us to a life of living in sin, or at least that's what most of us have been led to believe. Yet we still want to keep that connection with the higher power and often find ourselves not so much wanting to be sitting in the pew, but in our own homes and worshiping in our own way. Yet, even if we do find the church that is welcoming and embracing, it sometimes does seem that there's a mass exodus away from gathering together to celebrate the divinity. And the reason I'm talking about this today is because I met a guy a few weeks ago at the National Speakers Association. His name is Dr. Josh Packard, and he'll be joining us momentarily, who's written a really fascinating book called Church Refugees, where he takes a closer look at why millions of church members, regardless of their sexual orientation, okay, I want you to hear that, regardless of sexual orientation, they're falling into a space of inactivity and really skipping church altogether. And I thought this would be a really great conversation to have because I think there's some parallels to those of us who come out and then how in the world at large, it seems people are stepping away from these gatherings. His book is a pretty deep sociological research into the heart of the issue of why people are walking away from organizations. And I thought, you know what? What better way to dive into this to just go to one of the experts and see what is becoming of those who say they're kind of done with church, but not their faith. So I'd like to welcome to the podcast my new friend, Josh Packard. Hey, Josh.
Well, thank you, Rick, for having me here. And thanks for calling me a friend. That's great. That makes me happy.
Yeah. Well, I feel like we really connected when we met each other. And the more we talked, the more I became very fascinated. And then when you did get up and speak at National Speakers Association and took some of the findings from your book and even turned it into, you know, what we're finding in organizations such as national associations and people not, you know, imbibing, so to speak, as much as they used to in these programs, I just thought it would be some good parallels we could draw to what's going on in the LGBTQ world, because a lot of people do step away from their churches and their faith. Let's start with, what was the impetus behind this book for you? I know you're a sociologist, you're a doctor at University of Northern Colorado, you've got a doctorate and you are a professor and all that good stuff. So what was the real impetus behind this for you writing this book?
So the sociology of religion has been a subfield for me for a long time. You know, more broadly, I'm interested in people who are joining or leaving, more often leaving, voluntary associations of all kinds. I think it has dramatic consequences for our entire society if people are not getting together with each other in a variety of ways. And religion is one of those ways. So for me, this topic first came up. We're hearing a lot. The Pew Research Center did this research. They do lots of research, but they released this major report maybe 8 or 9 years ago about the nuns, the dramatic rise of the people who claim no religious affiliation. They're not Christian, Buddhist, Hindu, Jewish, or nothing. And I felt like that story was missing a key component, which was that everybody was talking about the decline of religion because there's the rise of the nuns. And I thought, well, you know, I think there's more nuance here than what we would normally be led to believe, because I kept running into a lot of people who said, no, I've retained my affiliation. I guess, you know, I'm still Christian or I'm still Jewish, but I have no interest in doing that in the sort of institutional setting. And so I got really interested. So we call these people the duns.
Right.
They're done with church. I thought that was really lining up with what a lot of what we were seeing in other industries and other sectors of society. And so that was really it. You know, that was about me wanting to tell that story and thinking that we could learn something by studying religion about the rest of our culture as well.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about the duns, give me a little, like, let's go a little bit deeper into that. When somebody says they're kind of done, what does that mean?
Yeah, so we're looking for people, you know, our study is really about people who are explicitly done attending church on Sunday mornings or on any sort of a regular basis. They're not done with God. That would make them a nun. So we're looking for people who retain their faith. And the reason for this is because we're trying to make that bridge about, you know, if we think about like, so people who are sort of opting out of the traditional public school system, it's not that they've stopped caring about the central premise that education is important and they want their kids to have a good experience. It's just that they don't believe in the traditional school system's ability to organize that education anymore. And so they're doing homeschooling or whatever. And sure. This is the religious version of that. People haven't stopped thinking that God is important. They just don't have any trust or faith that the institution can handle that understanding or expression or questions or doubts or faith or action or whatever about God.
I think this is a really good parallel, though, to how many LGBTQ individuals feel.
I mean, absolutely.
I know so many of them are still wanting the fellowship and everything, but what they find is sometimes, unless it's an open and affirming church, that they can't find a space to land, but they're not ready per se to walk away completely from all of their faith. They're ready to say, I'm still going to be a Christian, I'm going to still be Jewish, whatever, you know, faith it is they're practicing. But I'm going to find a way to do this in my own way. And I know for me, mine was a little bit similar, but different. I came to a space where I did keep faith in a bigger box, not particularly the faith that I was raised in. But I found it, you know, more of an adventure and an exploration to go see if I could find somewhere to land. So is that what you've found as you've done your research? As people tend to, once they say I'm kind of done, that they go to start exploring to see if they can find a place to land? Or are they really, really done with like the showing up in church every Sunday?
Well, I think part of it depends on where you are. It is a process. It's not a static, like, you know, we ask people to pinpoint days and times, and a lot of times they can do so retrospectively. But what we found is that the people who were in the middle of that process didn't really know where they were at in the middle of that process. So I'm not sure that people are aware of it even as they're necessarily stepping away. Mm-hmm. But it is the case, like you said, and we interviewed, you know, as you can imagine, a project like this, I was actually worried that we would, as we were doing our recruitment, we were very careful to diversify our points of recruitment for these interviews. Because some personal contacts that I have and my co-author has, we were worried about getting a very skewed sample on my end. I know a lot of people of faith who are LGBT, and I was frankly worried that we would have 50 respondents and 40 of them would be LGBT, and that wouldn't have been a problem. It just wouldn't have been the project I was necessarily working on.
Well, yeah, because I think those people, I mean, I know from my own experience, a lot of that leaving the quote church, so to speak, would be more based on the faith principles and, you know, things such as that.
Yeah. Right.
And then to go find somewhere where they feel embraced, it's not easy depending on where you live. I mean, I know in Southern California here, there are quite a few, you know, open and affirming churches, especially as you get more into Los Angeles area or the San Diego areas, any metropolitan area, I'm sure in the greater Denver area as well, there's plenty as well. But then when you get out of that range, that's when you start to have the problem. And for some people, you know, I'm like one of those people, I'm like, I'm totally cool if I'm not sitting in a pew, so to speak. Yet,
right.
Recently I was at a spiritual center for a presentation I did, and it kind of brought up those warm, fuzzy feelings of kind of being with some people on a Sunday morning, kind of doing my thing. And I wasn't a Sunday churchgoer because my faith is Seventh-day Adventist, so we actually practice on Saturdays. Uh-huh. But to me, it's still the practice. It's, you know, being there, getting the warm, fuzzies, all that stuff. I guess I could say I kind of got a little teary-eyed going, I kind of miss this.
Yeah.
But yet, when I think about, okay, what is it I'm really missing? I think it's more just the fellowship. And then you got to find the right fellowship to make it really work for you.
Right.
Is that what you kind of found through the study too? Is a lot of people were saying it's more about the fellowship?
So I think that's a part of what makes this such a tricky topic is that it is and it isn't. We didn't really run into anybody, LGBT or otherwise, frankly, who were replacing church with like a different social gathering. I mean, there is something, as much as a sociologist want to make the claims for the universality of what we're finding, there is also something fairly unique about being connected to the divine and doing that by being connected to other people. But that gets real hard when something that's intrinsic to your identity becomes the thing that's separating you from others. What I thought was super fascinating is that it was actually sort of the LGBT community members that we had interviewed, and a lot of them had walked away from church and God, so they weren't eligible for ours. But they seemed to be more okay, and I don't know if it's because they had better coping skills or if it's because they were more used to it or whatever. They were more okay sitting in pews of churches that they knew were not open and affirming, but that wasn't going to be like a deal breaker for them necessarily. The people who really had a problem with it were people who were straight advocates and allies who had more recently come to that position and had realized that they could no longer maintain their friendships and relationships outside of church with their gay friends while they were going to this kind of a church. Hmm. And that, frankly, like when I talk to church pastors, you know, to pastors and leaders of churches, they can be sort of okay with the numbers game of losing the potential membership of, you know, anywhere from 8 to 12% of the population that might identify as LGBT. But once they realized that it was starting to affect even their straight members, that's when they looked at me like, okay, we need to do something about that. And there's something real sad about that. But I think there's something really valiant in those efforts of like, it reaffirms how important relationships are to us, that they're just these straight allies and advocates are not, they're not willing to give up their friendships even for their God. Mm. And so they're finding, of course, what happens when you find those things is that you realize that you don't have to do that. Like, there are lots and lots of options, but a lot of them, frankly, just sort of are not happening on Sunday mornings. It is about community, even for those who are not necessarily being driven out, but for those who are just opting out.
Yeah. I find this interesting, you know, that you said some of the LGBTQ people were fine with sitting in the pew.
I don't mean, you know, they weren't like, you know.
But I get that.
They could deal with it.
Yeah, they could deal with it. And I understand that because I think part of this is, it stems from how we have been socialized, because most of us sat in those church pews for years.
Yeah, yeah, it really is a skill. I mean, not necessarily a skill that you would like to develop or one that we would encourage anyone. But yeah, you get better at it.
Yeah, you do. And it's a way that we had to show, had to, and I'm putting air quotes, even though nobody listening can see them. You know, we had to develop that ability because that's how we had to live in life. We had to walk through life not really saying, well, this is who I really am. So whether we were not saying this is who I really am in school or in church or at home or wherever it is, we created that altar exterior. And so to go sit in the church pew really wasn't any different than to go slide into a desk at school. You know, it was just kind of, okay, this is how we did it. What I do know from my own experience and having done some work in this arena, in fact, I was just at a spiritual center a few weeks ago and did a talk, is as I talked to those people about why this was their new gathering, they said, I don't have to hide. Right. And wherever I don't have to hide, I feel comfortable. And because of the kind of faith practice that's being delivered in that environment, there wasn't any, you must show up to be a part of this. You must be here on a weekly basis to be, you know, that overriding kind of theme wasn't being pushed in this particular environment. And so I think there's a lot of nuances that start to show up, and it depends on the faith. You know, some faiths are like, you have to be in church every Sunday and all, you know, even though I know in a modern secular world that we live in today, a lot of people don't feel that. But yet I know I have a lot of friends who every Sunday morning, or depending on how the mega churches, because I'm surrounded by a lot of mega churches.
Yes, you are.
You know, it could be Saturday night that they're doing their thing. It could be Sunday morning, Sunday evening. It's really about, this is part of their weekend and it's part of their social construct that they go to and makes them feel whole.
And you brought up such a good point about the part about wanting to not have to hide or be, you know, something that you're not. And the way we ended up coming to this, to talk about this in the book, which is a method that I think is not one that I invented, but one that served us really well, was about thinking about what are the, they're not paired opposites, but we talked about like, what is the thing that precludes the other from happening? And so what our respondents kept telling us was that they wanted authentic communities. And instead what they got was judgment. And and so if you think about this, like, you know, you can't really have a community if you're constantly worried about being judged. They don't mean cosmic judgment by God. They meant judgment by other people. You can't really be in community if you're worried that you're always being judged. And so you end up then hiding, you know, some part of, whether it's the fact that you drink or the fact that you curse or the fact that, you know, that you're gay or whatever status is being stigmatized in that religious setting. And then the authenticity is gone. And when the authenticity leaves, the community leaves.
Yeah. And I think that's a big piece for everybody in any kind of organization. You did such a beautiful job when you presented at NSA about this, that it's not just the faith-based organizations that should be looking at this. There's lots of, quote, organizations that are seeing a decline in memberships because it's just not what people are looking for any longer, or what they are looking for is not in alignment with what the organizations are offering.
Right. Yeah. And it's, I mean, I think that for far too long, the organizations have been, you know, so busy trying to connect, whether it's churches or whatever, they've been so busy trying to connect people to them, all the while their level of trust is slowly eroding with the general public, and they've forgotten to connect people to each other.
Right.
And if you see that, I mean, that's really the most, whether it's a spiritual center or whatever, those are the most powerful organizations. The ones that we trust the most, the ones that we frankly use and interact with the most, are the ones that help us to connect with the people around us or the other people, you know, whether it's around us virtually or around us.
So as you've unraveled some of this information and seen this, so the question would be, as a researcher, I guess I would ask, so what's the outcome? What do you see being the next phase? Is this going to be a continuing thing, you think? Are we going to see a surge in organizations trying to revamp to go, okay, let's make this more about the people than the organization? What are you finding? Because you did the research, so now you have to have the solution, right?
Well, look, I think that our move towards more and more communities of affinity is not going away. Let's think about information technology for a minute. Like, we have, you know, all of this ability to make the internet into whatever we want it to be. And what we consistently choose to make it into is this place where we get to interact with each other, sometimes in really terrible ways. Mm-hmm. I think way more often than not, in ways that allow for podcasts like yours that are reaching people that, you know, maybe need a voice like yours and don't have access to one because of where they live or the type of family that they grow up in, et cetera. And so this idea that the internet is going to be, that our information technology is indicative of what we value, I don't think that's going away anytime soon. That our values lie in getting closer to one another, to bridging this modern world gap where we often feel so disconnected from the people we physically are next to. Companies and corporations, you know, churches, voluntary groups, whatever, the ones that figure it out, the ones that we're going to be talking about in 20 and 30 and 40 years, the ways that people are getting together physically are going to be the ones that figure out this thing about how to bring people not closer to them, but how to bring people closer to one another.
I think this is interesting, though, because as you see people stepping away from these organizations, and again, I'm going to go to the broader thing, whether it's a church or an association or, you know, I mean, I know it's happening in my own community, in the LGBTQ community, that, you know, to try to get someone involved in an LGBTQ center right now is like pulling teeth, and not just, you know, volunteers, so to speak, but bringing people into the centers. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, well, I can find this online. So it seems like we're kind of, yes, the beauty of the internet world and technology and all these beautiful things that are happening are enabling us to reach people in a lot of different ways, but it's also causing this divide of, well, I don't really have to interact with you live in real time. So I think that brings another sociological, you know, front to go explore.
But that is the thing. I mean, I think that is deep down what we all crave. It's just that institutions, organizations aren't doing a very good job of it. You know, it's not that I don't want to interact face to face. It's that I do. I just want to do it in meaningful ways. So even in the chapter where we talk about why people are so turned off by doctrine, it's because it's this narrow version of doctrine. You know, our respondents say things like, why can't we do everything else that Jesus commands in the New Testament? And then let's talk about homosexuality. Mm-hmm. Why don't we get all the other stuff right first? And this other person says, you know, I wanted to drugs and sex. I wanted to feed the poor and they just wanted to police me. It was always about drugs and sex, which I think is like, which is such a great way. Like, I don't want to go to that institution. I would love to interact with people, but around ways that are meaningful and valuable. And those ways are more often than not just not things that the organization understands. And furthermore, and I think more importantly, in terms of as we expand this out to things like an LGBT center, is that we don't trust that the institution can get it right. Mm-hmm. We're not inclined to do that. We're like, oh, we'll give it a shot and see what happens. At this point, we've all built up enough cumulative social knowledge that institutions are probably not going to get it right, that we don't even give them the benefit of the doubt and try. We would rather interact with 100 strangers to find 3 that we like online and build something that way.
Yeah.
Because institutions are just not built that way right now.
Well, they're not. And I think institutions also, you know, tend to somewhat mimic other institutions. You know, they see somebody else doing something, they're like, okay, well, that's working for them, so let's do that. We'll take what we can from them, and then we'll put a little bit of twist on it. And I will, you know, I love my LGBT community, but this is one of the things that I think as a community, our LGBT centers aren't doing the best job with coming out. They do a lot of work with the coming out youth and the 20 somethings, but there's a whole other population that's coming out. It could be the 30 plus, the 35, the 40 plus. I mean, I was 36 when I came out of the closet. And when I went to the centers, there really wasn't anything because it was all about the younger generation. And I think this is where associations and, you know, any institution really can do themselves a disservice by not going, okay, let's look at the overall population. Now, I realize
Or your local context.
Yeah, exactly.
Where, you know, where are you located and what's missing? And
what's missing in that area that is a need?
Happen.
Yeah, a need that needs to be served. And I realize it's hard to think that you can serve everyone, but sometimes just asking the question, what's missing, what's being underserved, is the answer you most need. And then at that point, you can address stuff. So I'm going to go back again to the spiritual center where I spoke. I found it just, and I know it's not the only place that's doing this, but just the fact that they were live streaming the entire service through the internet, to me, was saying, we're trying to accommodate those that we can who can't make it here. And they're a small spiritual center. It's now just in their first big growth pattern, to the point where they're considering having to do two services on a Sunday morning. But it shows that intuitiveness to go, okay, how can we better serve? And what's the means by which we can make this available? And I even talked to the pastor afterwards, and we were talking about this entire conversation, actually, about what is he doing to try to keep people engaged, and how does he feel about, you know, offering the distance, you know, services, so to speak. And he says, you know, I just know that in our world, the more people we can reach by using technology, the better off we are. But we also want to make it such that when they see the service live, if they could be there, we want to make it such that they want to be there. They want to come.
Right.
It make it enticing enough they want to be there. So I think there's the fine balance that happens. So as you've done this work, and I know you've focused the book on the churches, but what are some of the other organizations you're seeing this really starting to crop up in?
Well, I think we see this a lot in the ways that we engage with the so-called sharing economy, right? Mm. The things like Airbnb, Uber, et cetera, that part of what was once seen as an impediment to being able to make money off of my car, letting a stranger into it, or my house, crying out loud, is actually now seen as, it is a feature. It is not a bug. It is a feature that I get to meet someone and interact with them in this. We're not becoming best friends with these people.
Sure.
But again, like, here's an example of a company or organizations that have figured out how to bring people together. They're not trying to bring all the people to them, and they're trying to get the people to interact with one another. And also, even for me, like, I'm a Gen Xer. I'm perfectly fine, for the most part, interacting with nameless, faceless corporations. And in fact, occasionally find it tedious when I have to email back and forth with my Airbnb host. But then I find out that when I actually do, I like it. I do sort of like knowing whose house I'm walking into. And it is better than a hotel.
Right.
So I think that it's the for-profit world that, frankly, you know, they're probably the ones who are going to figure out this innovation first, and they're probably going to go after it hardest. But it's happening everywhere. The biggest place that I would say is at risk of not figuring out for a very long time and doing the most sort of harm to our society is local politics. Mm. I think that we're really in danger of losing an entire generation. And Bernie supporters might argue differently with me, and we'll see if they're going to actually do what he called them to do and enter local politics en masse. But that has yet to play out, right? We are seriously in danger of losing an entire generation or more of people who are willing to give up a lot of hours for very little reward or pay or anything to work for their local municipalities, sitting on city council, running for the, you know, whatever boards are available and that kind of stuff. The things that keep our society humming, because that structure is a lot more rigid. I mean, it's real. How do you bring people together in those things? Nobody's going to these public forum meetings, and or very few people are, unless there's a huge controversy.
Right.
So that's a model that I think needs some tinkering with. And I would say that's probably the spectrum. You know, places that have a profit to make, they're going to figure this out. And they're going to figure it out, frankly, in a way that you like it. They're not going to trick you or dupe you or anything. You're not going to, you know, they're going to figure it out in a way that will make you want to say, yes, I want to do that. I want to buy that. I want to go there. I want to do that. And then nonprofits and voluntary associations will figure it out next. And then hopefully, you know, God knows our municipality.
Right. So what's been the most surprising thing you saw in this research as you were doing it?
You probably know this, but I'm a straight white male. So this was surprising to me. I don't ever, you know, if I choose to, I can sort of make my way through society where I never have to spend a whole lot of time interacting with people who disagree with me. I hope it's not what I choose to do, but I recognize that is my privilege.
Right.
What I was stunned by over and over again in this process, we've done 130 some interviews now, is the amount at which these people that were in our project kept telling us, not only am I okay being in a congregation where I actively disagree with the people sitting next to me, that is actually what I want. they would say things like, God is too big for any one person to figure out and understand, meaning the pastor telling me every week what it's supposed to be. Yeah. So I need a bunch of different perspectives and people around me in order to truly figure this thing out. And that floored me. The first time I heard it, I thought, I'll never hear that again. And it probably had to happen 30 times before I got it through my skull that this is a characteristic that defines this group of people.
Mm-hmm. I think that comes from how much searching we do in the LGBTQ world to finally say, this is who I am. There's so many times we have to hear it over and over again that, okay, I'm looking for myself. I'm finding myself. I'm trying to be, you know, who I'm supposed to be. And in mm-hmm. that search, we ask the question, okay, is this really who I am or is it not? Is this really who I am or is it not? Do I really have that attraction? Do I not? And it can happen in a matter of, you know, very few weeks that realization comes, but the questions keep getting asked over and over again. Oh. And I think that kind of sets the pattern the same way that we talked about, you know, that you can go sit in a church and go, I can be here kind of, you know, undercover, so to speak, and be okay with that. It's just because this is the stuff we've had to do to get by in life. And that questioning is part of our own exploration. I would say that it was interesting. I was doing a presentation a week or so ago, and I talk, one of the four tenets that I talk about in most of my speeches and everything is curiosity, courage, confidence, and commitment. Mm-hmm. And I always bring forth that LGBTQ people are probably some of the most curious people in the world because they've had to question everything from the moment that they realized there was something different about who they were. And I think that imbibes, you know, that brings up that just deep level of constant curiosity to keep asking the questions, why, when, who, you know, all those questions that we deal with, especially the why. If this is mm-hmm. really true, why is it true? And I think it's...
And again and again and again.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, you wake up on a Monday and you're like, all right, I'm going to start this process. And then by Friday, you know, you make your way through all four
of
those components.
I mean, I think the other thing too is for someone who is LGBTQ, and I'm going to take this to another realm as well, but I'm going to start with the LGBTQ person. We never stop coming out. I mean, let's just take how you and I met. I mean, in the moment that we were starting our first conversations, it wasn't very long where I felt like, okay, I think I feel good with this guy. I can kind of go where I'm going. And I had to come out. You know, it's like mm-hmm. we're always doing this, you know. However, to take that to a wider tangent, as I'm doing the work that I'm doing and starting to work with people on coming out in lots of different ways, what I'm finding is even my entrepreneurial clients, they never stop coming out about being an entrepreneur either, because at the moment somebody says, well, what do you do? Well, I own my own business and da-da-da. Oh, that must be hard. You know, they have to kind of go, here we go. We have to go through all the same justification, you know, of why we're doing this. Yet you flip it over to a very traditional 9-to-5 sort of job. And I find it interesting that most people who are in those jobs, they kind of go down the same path of having to justify what they do, even though they may love it. It's like, we're all coming out to explain who we are and why we do what we do. And that's the reason I think this coming out journey is everybody's journey, no matter how you look at it.
Right. And those skills, I mean, the skills of being able to deal with doubt and to be able to deal with questions and to make sense out of your life through a series of conversations. I mean, those are skills that we all need. I mean, frankly, mm-hmm. part of the specifically with the church, that idea that one person is going to, you know, hand down the truth for you and you'll stop having, you know, real questions or struggles with your belief for the rest of your life is absurd.
I don't think you ever stop questioning, because as society evolves and as time marches on, there's always going to be new questions to take us to a space of, okay, well, how does that fit with me? And how does that align with my values? And does that fit for how I choose to be in life? So, mm-hmm. well, this is awesome. So I have one last question that I usually ask at the end of every conversation. Because of the beautiful research you've done, this may be something you'll just tie back to the book. But if you could give someone a piece of advice who's really searching and wanting to really step into who they are, whether they're LGBTQ or whoever they may be, starting a business and wanting to belong, what would be one of those pieces of advice you'd love to leave the listeners with on really being who you are and just fitting in however you do fit into society?
You know, I have to deal with, like I said, about my privilege earlier, I have to deal with very little of this, but I do occupy a relatively unorthodox space inside of academia. And I would just caution people about your thoughts and your dreams and your questions and your wishes are so incredibly important. They shouldn't just be entrusted to anyone. You know, like there are times in that process that we're all so vulnerable when we're just trying out a new idea, and we're also excited because we think it resonates and it fits, and you get really amped up, I think, to get to step into this personality, this idea of who you are that feels so much like you. Mm-hmm. And yet, as we're doing that questioning, I think the tendency can be to share things with people that probably aren't worthy of that trust and don't have your best interests in mind. And I know those people can be hard to find, but it's worth holding on to, you know, whatever those questions are until you find the right person to ask them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the support is really, really important. And I'm glad you said what you said, because you do. I remember us talking about this at the conference, how you do occupy interesting space in academia, just as a sociologist. It's like, right. Where do you really fit in the grand scheme of, you know, college and university graduations, yeah, and all that sort of stuff? And
well,
in your
and
own way.
As a sociologist
way,
wants to actually like talk to people outside of the academy.
Right.
I mean, that's the really weird thing. That's the thing that most people, my colleagues don't understand.
Right. And in your own way, that's your own coming out story right there is, you know, I want to be doing things slightly different than what the expectation is. And I think he just beautifully demonstrated that this is what I mean when I say everybody's got a coming out story. Well, Josh, I so appreciate you taking the time to join us here on the Coming Out Lounge today. It's been great. I know there will be just bits of wisdom people picked up, and hopefully somebody will really look at why they've chosen to step away from their faith-based religion and feel a little more comfortable with, okay, yeah, I really do get what's going on for me. And maybe they'll find their way back to someplace that fits, and maybe they won't. And maybe this gave him the permission to go, cool, I'm going to just kick back on my Sunday mornings and do it the way I'm going to do it and have my relationship with my higher power and the way I'm going to do it. So thanks so much for being here.
And there are other people out there who are looking to, you know, transition into small home worships and community services and stuff like that. So they're out there. You're not alone.
You know, it's very interesting, too, that point you just brought up, because if we think back to how this country, you know, started, all of that started in the homes.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't, I mean, we had people living miles and miles from one another. And so there were just small pockets. And then this other organizational stuff started showing up as pockets grew and more populations. But I think it's interesting to see that as much as social media and everything enables us to be connected across the globe, there's still this really burning, yearning desire to be connected on an intimate level as well.
Absolutely.
Appreciate your time. Thanks so much. And look forward to maybe having you on again another time.
Yeah, hopefully. And hopefully our paths will cross again.
Oh, I'm sure they will. I'm sure they will. Thanks again, Josh.
All right. Thank you.
Hey, 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 Closet Dwellers and Coming Out Lounge listeners. I wanted to invite you to check something out. You know, for all the years that I've been a Coming Out coach, one thing I've learned is sometimes people come to do the work with me and they only need a little bit of help to get over something very particular and very important to them. It could be reconciling their religion and sexuality. Maybe it's learning how to have the difficult conversations where they say, I'm gay. Possibly it could be, oh my God, I'm out of the closet, but now how do I do this same-sex dating and mating sort of thing? Well, what I can tell you is throughout the years, there are common things that show up over and over and over again. And what I've heard most from my clients and listeners of the podcast is, I want a way to work with you just on these particular subjects. Yay, I am so excited because I've taken the action and I've made this possible. So how do you find out about these particular programs? You go to thecomingoutcoach.com, or if you're on the show page right now listening to the podcast or have just listened to the podcast, over to the right-hand side of the podcast description, everything is an icon that says one-on-one coaching sessions. Click on that button, you'll be taken to a page that describes each of the different 9 sessions I'm offering. They are one-on-one sessions that we can do via phone, Skype, or even FaceTime. They're very action-oriented. We go right to the topic that you want to talk about. And each of these sessions also includes a copy of my book, Frankly, My Dear, I'm Gay. So what more could you ask for? You get me for 90 minutes devoted to you, plus my book. So go check it out. See if there's something that could help you as you step out, step up, and step in to living your powerful truth. Take care. I'm Rick Clemens, the Coming Out Coach. I look forward to working with you.
You've just experienced the Coming Out Lounge. Go online to www.comingoutlounge.com to learn more. And tune in again next week for more stories and tips for being true to yourself.